Welcome back to the 11th Hour. The British-born, Tipperary-reared author and singer Julian Gough was a recent winner of the BBC Radio 4 National Short Story Prize. And the winning story features as a prologue to his latest novel, Jude, Level 1. The novel tells the surreal and comic tale of an orphan, Jude, as he sets out his 18th birthday to discover the world, or at least other parts of Ireland, where he falls in love in Galway before heading for the inferno of Dublin. And Julian joins me now on the line from Berlin to tell me more about the novel. Julian Gough, you're very welcome to the 11th Hour.
Thanks for having me.
This novel has been described as a genre-bending novel. What genres have you bent?
I'd say by the end of it, I've probably bent most of them. It was only after, actually, I just got the copy of the book in my hand and I was talking to my mother about it down the phone, and she was saying she didn't actually know what a genre was. So I was very upset to hear that. Genres, I suppose it has bits of thrillers and James Bond movies and anything I could stick in there, really. I wanted to put them all in a blender, like The Simpsons does, you know. Steal from everywhere.
The main character, Jude, he's a bit of a Candide, a sort of an innocent abroad, is he not?
He is, yeah, yeah. Well, he's even innocent at home. Yeah, it's very Candide-like. That's a classic way of looking at the world, and I stole it off Voltaire, so well spotted.
But he doesn't seem to have even got the attack of Candide. He's just true love is all that he chases.
Yeah, yeah, he does. And, you have to chase something, don't you, in life? And it's kind of arbitrary what you chase.
Well, so the options are cash or true love, are they not?
I think they are cash or true love, yeah. And he's moving through an Ireland that's kind of more and more about cash. And it's much more interesting if he's going against the grain of the country and trying to find something else. So he chases true love through Celtic Tiger Ireland, and that doesn't get you anything but trouble.
Did you deliberately set the orphanage idea up so they wouldn't know about life when he left the orphanage, that he lived in a rarefied enclosure before he left for the real world?
Yeah, I did. And in a way, I'd say that's more autobiography than anything else. It's, I grew up in Tipperary, and it's not probably the greatest preparation for the 21st century, you know. You know, when I arrived there as a child, It was a different Ireland, and it was a different world, you know. I mean, we were still kind of excited about electricity. It wasn't anything like it is now. And I suppose I really wanted to tell the story of where we've come from over the last kind of 30 years, but kind of speed it up. Have it all happen in a mad rush to one guy.
I suspect the Tipperary People's Association will not be giving you a Tipperary Person of the Year award after this.
The vote would be split down the middle, I'd say. Actually, I've been invited to read in Drumoneer fairly soon, so you know, I'm not totally.
They're still able to laugh at themselves, are they?
Some are. I'd say there'll be some heated discussions, which is exactly what you want, really. I mean, there'll be sides taken, I suppose. Yeah, but sure, you know, what's life without a conflict?
A conflict, exactly. But go back to Tipperary. The Tipperary section of the book starts off with Jude going on his 18th birthday with the orphans to have a guard of honour at an opening of a new interpretive centre.
Yeah.
What was the centre interpreting?
The centre was interpreting a tremendously historic location in a bog in Tipperary. The very bog hole where Eamon de Valera hid from the British Army during the War of Independence and had his vision of Ireland. And he's going there for the ceremony for the official reopening of Dev's Hole. And as the minister says in the speech at the time, remember, always remember, a vision of Ireland came out of Dev's Hole. And the ceremony then goes horribly wrong, and it's all Jude's fault, so he has to flee.
Yeah. The open, that section is a kind of a cutting parody of Fianna Fáil and the De Valera dynasty. It's led in this instance by Brumhilde De Valera, Minister for Beef, Culture and the Islands. What has Fianna Fáil done on you?
Nothing. No, I mean, I've great affection for them. I mean, I think it's a very affectionate portrait of Fianna Fáil all the way through the book. I mean, I think I must have the most sympathetic portrait of Charlie Haughey that's ever been delivered in fiction. I'm fascinated. Fianna Fáil are great. Fianna Fáil are us. I mean, they are, you know, they always get elected, so they obviously speak to our soul in some kind of way, and I think they're honest about the kind of characters we are, and so we forgive them everything, because we know that we'd probably do the same if we were in their position. I think we have a great democracy in that even the corruption and the scandals and the dodginess of our politicians we feel we own that too, that they're genuinely representing us, you know, even in their crimes and their sins. They're
one of our own.
They're one of our own, yeah. I think we have a great democracy. Yeah.
In the book, you mix up real-life characters. You said you mentioned Charlie Hoy, and you have Stephen Hawking, and you have Pat Sheeran from Galway is in there as a hero.
Yeah.
And you have imaginary creations. How do you decide which to use, and why did you decide to use both?
Oh, it's wildly intuitive. I mean, you're writing it, you're making all kinds of decisions on all kinds of levels that aren't always conscious. I mean, sometimes it just... Well, Charlie Hawley, you couldn't have anyone else play him. There's no point. I actually, in an early version of the book, I mean, I've rewritten some of these scenes 50 times. You know, they're at a pretty high polish by the time I let go of them. And in early scenes, I tried a fictional version of Charlie, and I couldn't make him work. It always turned back into Charlie. So Charlie went in intact. And some other people, you think, no, that other person is representing something broader, and he needs to be fictional, or she needs to be fictional, you know. And then the mixture of that, I think, is, I like it, it satisfies me. I draw probably more on The Simpsons than I do on, you know, Henry James. I like the way The Simpsons mix up real characters and imaginary characters, and if you get it right, you have something that's got the power of truth and the power of fiction firing on all cylinders at the same time, if you get it right.
I am fascinated by your character, Jimmy Bungle O'Bliss.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
He's a great character. He's probably an archetypal Irish character at this stage, is he not?
He is. Now, he's one of the guys, I didn't need a specific guy, I needed an archetype, the couture, you know. And Jimmy O'Bliss, Jimmy Bungle O'Bliss, is the greatest property developer in Ireland. No deal of his has ever fallen through. And I like him a lot, yeah, yeah. He's a dark.
But the property developers are bad news in this book. They buy churches, demolish them. They demolish asylums and have the whole inmates of the asylum going down the street shouting out for care in the community.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm probably not. Yeah, I'm not very kind to. Well, I mean, he's more than a property developer in a way. He stands for both sides of the modern Ireland, like the kind of knock everything and whatever you replace it with will be better, which is very Bakunin. It's very like the Russian anarchists who would have been around before the revolution happened in Russia, where they said, basically, let's just destroy everything and whatever you build in its place will be miles better. And there is a sort of element of that in what we've done over the last 20 or 30 years. And some of the things that have come up have been better and some have not. And I like the energy of Jimmy O'Bliss. You can't deny his fantastic energy, you know. But I suppose I draw on Flann O'Brien more than James Joyce. You'd have to say that, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. Who would you describe as your literary influences?
Well, I love a lot of people, and there's an awful lot of influences in the book, but they're not even all from literature. I mean, there's a lot of economics.
The Simpsons, obviously.
There's a lot of The Simpsons. There's a lot of economic writers that nobody in literature gives a damn about, but I think are very interesting and explain a lot of things about the modern world. In literature, I think that Flann O'Brien took the Boreen less travelled, and I think he invented a way of talking about the world, and particularly a way of talking about Ireland, that wasn't, I don't think we've, he didn't even know what to do with it, I think. You know, I mean, he wrote a couple of masterpieces, three if you put in Unbailed Box, so yeah, three masterpieces, and he didn't believe in his own genius. He was better than he knew he was, and he left an awful lot of tools lying around that nobody's picked up, I think. So I picked him up and used him, because comedy is the way to understand reality in Ireland. Realism isn't good enough, I think.
Yeah, to make a joke, but to get the real meaning of it.
Yeah, I think in a way, I think life is a cosmic joke. It's more life is more of a joke than it is a tragedy, and the tools of Flann O'Brien will get you closer to it than the tools of James Joyce, especially these days. You know,
the story of Jude has been published in an unusual way. Tell me how we can read future installments.
Well, Jude Level 1 comes out as a book in paperback and hardback now. And that's the first third of it. That's the Irish third of it. Level 2 and Level 3 are set in London and Nevada in the United States. And they're going to be published online through my publisher. So either through juliangough.com or oldstreetpublishing.com. You'll be able to basically read the next two installments, which is the next 300 or 400 pages, free on the internet. And next year, then, we'll publish the whole damn thing in a big, lovely hardback. But basically, you can keep reading free right to the end of the book if you want to. Because we don't want people to feel, because once they've bought the first bit, that they have to stop for a year to find out what happens next.
And what was the idea behind that? Is it just a marketing thing, or is it just to keep the energy levels up?
Well, it's probably pure foolishness on our part, but I'm a big believer in giving stuff away. I'm a big believer in if you're generous with your readers, they'll be generous back to you. And not even in a selfish terms. I think it's good to give, you know. And if you're giving away 2/3 of a big book that you've spent a lot of time on, I think people, they'll send bits of it they like to their friends, they'll talk about it, and by the time you actually publish the hardback with a big 530-page novel or whatever, you'll have built an audience for yourself in a good way rather than a bad way, in a generous way rather than a kind of tight way. And I think that ultimately you'll end up, I think, reaching a lot more readers and selling a lot more books. So that's how I sell it to my publisher anyway. It might not work. They might just read it for nothing.
Well, it's kind of like the rock and roll thing of doing the support acts to get the album sold when you get it made, you know?
Yeah, well, it's even more like, I would say, the rock and roll thing of giving away some songs free on the internet to build an audience, and then eventually you bring out your album. And even though people might have heard a lot of the songs for free, they say, well, I like these guys. I feel a bond with these guys because they've talked to me directly and they've given me stuff for nothing and they've sent me an email. I'll buy their album. So the Arctic Monkeys did that. You know, they built a big audience by giving away songs free on the internet, giving away their demos. And when the album came out, I think they were surprised to go straight to number one, because they didn't realize how many people had passed it on to their passed songs on to their friends and told their friends about it. And that's really important. I think that because we have such a corporate culture now, and because publishing has become very corporate as well, and in a way that feeds back into literature, because they only want to publish something that's got a guaranteed market. If you're not comfortable with that, if you're trying to write weird stuff on your own, one way of escaping the corporate trap, I think, is to try and talk directly to people, try and answer your emails, try and put your address out there and talk to people and do readings and get it back to the person-to-person thing that that storytelling in Ireland has always been about, ultimately. And if you can get it back to that pub conversation level, people will talk to their friends about you and say, look, if he's in town, you've got to go to the reading, or here, I'll email you a chapter of the book for nothing. There's ways of using the technology to actually make it more intimate rather than less, and that's what we're trying to do with this. I don't know if it'll work. But I don't think anyone's done it this way before, but we'll see what happens.
You're living in Berlin now.
I am.
Did you move to Berlin because you wrote this book and had a very cynical viewpoint of Ireland and put yourself into exile, did you?
No, I don't think it's a cynical view of Ireland, this book. It's a little bit... I mean,
it's vicious and cutting, Julian.
Well, you know, it's that and it's some other things. I think it's vicious and cutting and it's affectionate at the same time, which probably makes people a little bit uneasy, because you're usually meant to choose between them, you know. You're usually meant to either be a vicious satirist who disapproves of what he's satirizing, or you're doing an affectionate portrait and you approve of what you're satirizing. And when you do both in the same book, it does make some people a bit uneasy. I don't think anyone would be able to get through the book without finding something that didn't make them a little bit uncomfortable. But I'm not attacking the country. I'm trying to understand the country, and the country isn't all good. You can't just say, Asher, we're lovely. But it's not all bad either, and you can't just kick it around the place. So trying to put everything in, some of it's going to be pretty vicious. But I didn't flee the country because I was expected to be stoned in Ireland when it came out. I just couldn't afford to live in Ireland. I spent 7 years writing an epic novel about the modern world, and I ran out of money. And Ireland is not a good place to run out of money in. So I ended up in Berlin, kind of, because it's the cheapest, interesting city to live in Europe. So that's why.
When the Dublin Tourism Authority reads your section on Dublin, they won't want you back, I assure you.
Well, Dublin, I think the Dublin Tourist Authority might have one of the biggest problems with the book, yeah.
Regardless, I'm sure they have a sense of humour, because the book is extremely funny.
Ah, good, good. It's meant to be, yeah. I mean, it's... Dublin had the unfortunate honour of being the Inferno in my book, because the Inferno has to be somewhere. He has to have go through the dark places and have be tested in his if he's searching for true love. You know, you have to go through a pretty dark night of the soul. And unfortunately, he does it in Dublin. And that leads to a pretty brutal vision of Dublin, yeah.
Yeah,
but I think you'd have to admit there's elements of truth in it.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed the section on Dublin, I must say.
Good.
Anyways, Julian, thank you very much for being with us and talking to us on the 11th Hour.
Thanks, Warwick. It's a pleasure. Glad you liked it.
Jude, Level 1, is published by Old Street and is available now.